Welcome today. Thank you for taking time at the end of a long day that has started for some quite early with work or hikes and all things to attend to a conversation that it's very significant, I think, for all of our lives, and that in many ways will shape our lives and our conversation in the near future as a nation. One of the things that we'll draw reflections on today will be on a situation of an immigration raid that took place in Postville, Iowa, somewhere in here in the middle of the Midwestern dots. It's a small town in northeast Iowa. 2,300 people was the population at the time of the town at the time of the raid. So we'll address some reflections on that and share a little bit of where I'm after work that the community has done in response to this immigration raid in Postville that has brought a lot of reflection, a lot of questioning, and a lot of conversation to our community about immigration, particularly thinking of the community of Postville and the experience there as a place that demands our attention as a nation, even though it's such a small town and a fairly remote part of the country, that is quite telling about some of the challenges that we face as a nation when we consider conversations about immigration. The conversation we have tonight is one that is very controversial for many folks, so I hope that we can enter into it with a couple of basic ground rules, so to speak. First is that we have to recognize that conversations on a topic tend to be generalization, so we have to be mindful of that. Much of what I'll try to say, take with a grain of salt, knowing that we are still, you know, I speak from my experience and the experience of others that I have shared with, but I recognize also that the experience of others may vary. So I hope that we can all share openly about our experiences and understandings of this very important topic. On campus at Luther College, it's about 25 minutes from Postville, Iowa. We've had a long relationship with the town of Postville, in large part because it's such an interesting community. Postville, Iowa, again, with a population of 2,300 people as of the time of the raid last year on May 12th, about 300 of them were Hasidic Jews. Postville actually had the highest per capita number of rabbis in the world. That's because it's such a small town and so many rabbis. Anybody know why there's so many rabbis in Postville, Iowa? Meatpacking plant. This is a kosher meatpacking plant. In fact, Agriprocessors, which is the name of the company that is in Postville, or was until recently, Agriprocessors came to control 70% of the kosher meat market in the country. And so this is a huge, huge impact on a particular market. It's not an extremely large meatpacking plant. I mean, when you look at the Midwest, packing plants can be huge. So this one, by size, was not quite as large as some of the other ones, but it was very significant to the kosher market. And it was a product of the genius of creating a different marketing way of, kosher meat was the work primarily of delis, of kosher delis around the country. That was one thing that to be able to keep the meat kosher, it needed to be slaughtered in a particular way and cut and, prepared in a particular way. And so when you think about Jewish communities, the delis are a huge central part of those, the Jewish delis. And so what the owners of Agriprocessors managed to do in the 80s is to convince people that a label could be trusted that the meat had been processed properly and then sold not in a deli, but in a regular supermarket. So that's how they came over time, starting in the early 80s, to control 70% of the meatpacking industry, of the kosher meatpacking industry in the country. Of course, one of the challenges and the reason that I think is very significant to pay attention to Postville, and we'll talk some more about this as we go into it, is that rural communities have a very different story when it comes to immigration. Most of our conversations around immigration are based on the struggles, opportunities, challenges that urban communities face. When we think of immigration, we think of large cities in California, in Texas, in Florida, perhaps in some of the eastern states. Seldom do we think of rural areas. And it is urban centers that determine, and their situations that determine our national policy on immigration oftentimes. But the needs for immigration in rural areas are quite different than those in in urban centers. In the case of Postville, the meatpacking plant moved there in the 80s. Does anybody know why a meatpacking plant would move to the middle of nowhere in the 80s?
You mean middle of nowhere? Now listen.
Mm-hmm. when we went to, the interesting thing about Postville is, when people tried to find Postville from the news, everybody got lost. The New York Times got lost, they had their GPS, and they could not find it.
It's just turnabout, because we can't find our way in New York either.
So we'll qualify that. Not really. In the middle of a beautiful, which is a very beautiful area of the country.
There it is.
But why did the meatpacking plant move to Postal Island? And think about this. The community moved from New York. This Hasidic community, the entire community moved from the heart of New York to the middle of Northeast Iowa.
Cheap labor.
Close to the producers.
Cheap labor.
Cheap land.
Cheap
land. No railroads for distribution of product, but some centrality. So there's a variety of reasons why the company would have moved there. Some of these apply. The biggest one was a couple of shifts. One is the farming crisis was happening right before in the 70s and 80s. What we're seeing now in housing was happening with farms. Many people are familiar with that. Lots of people were losing their farms, so you had cheap labor available. People who were farmers who had inherited land had to either sell their land, lost their land, and then needed to find another work. So there was, not only was there a move to Postville, Iowa, many other meatpacking productions were moved out of the large urban centers they had been central to rural communities, and that was happening in Postville. The location of the cattle, of course, if you're going to slaughter kosher meat, you have to slaughter them in a certain way. Well, if you're shipping the cattle live from the Midwest out to New York, even though much of it came from upstate New York, but a lot of it was being shipped in from the Midwest, shipping live cattle is quite a difficult process. So it was cheaper to move the production to the source in Iowa. The challenge in terms of labor, though, became that as this company grew, those people that I've spoken with identified themselves as displaced farmers, who had lost their land and then were needing to do work, and then they went to work at a place like agri-processors and meatpacking in other places, didn't stay in that work very long, because if they had options, they went for them, because the work is very grueling and very demanding. Not that people don't like working hard, it's just that if they had another option and they could make more money, they would go elsewhere to do it. And if they had mobility, they pursued it. Even those who stayed with it for longer period of times, their children were very unlikely to stay. And this is a challenge in most of our rural communities. So that then if you have a growing industry in a small town that requires increasingly more and more labor as it grows, and you have a diminishing population in that community, you have a problem of supply of labor in those communities. So that's the picture that was happening in Postville. So we'll a lot of our conversation today will be based on kind of reflecting on Postville itself.
Did they go and build the plant?
There was an existing plant there. There were actually two plants, both of which, one had closed, one was still open. And they actually purchased one that had closed earlier in the 80s. So, okay.
Part of that problem trying to maintain a low wage base, you could maybe keep a few kids or some other folks there if you were willing to increase the salaries of the guys that were working there.
And I think that's one of the challenges that, and we'll come to that at the end to try to figure this out, because I think that's a very difficult economic question, with how used we are to purchasing cheap meat, for example, or cheap products. It's difficult to talk about increasing wages as if it's only a problem of the factories themselves providing decent wages. Meat is cheaper today than it was in the 70s when meatpacking production was done by labor union workers, and then it was a much more attractive job. So definitely that's a possibility. Postville again represents a little bit of a different picture, and we'll get to that as to whether is it only a matter of offering good enough salaries to attract the labor force? Is there a price that for sure will attract labor force to this kind of work? So part of my I gotta go to the right place. Okay. I was hearing at Holden about 6 years ago for the first time for Abriendo Caminos, which is what will happen next week here at Holden. This is a week when the village turns completely to Spanish. It's quite an incredible experience, where absolutely everything, the Bible studies, announcements, worship, all of it is done in Spanish. As a large group of folks from migrant communities come to Holden Village to celebrate this this week, along with other folks who are interested, who are some bilingual and some not. And so it's a great week together. When I heard about Abriendo Caminos and was asked to come and be part of the teaching staff that week, I must confess that my reaction was, what? Where are people going to come to Holden from? Who's going to travel from California and Florida and Texas to come to Holden Village? You know, from the immigrant community, a community that may not know about Holden. Little did I know, as a Hispanic immigrant myself, about the huge immigrant population that is part of Central Washington. And so coming to Holden was an introduction to me to something that I was really very little aware of in this community. When the Postville raid happened about a year ago, I got very involved in the response, along with many people at the college, at Luther, and others in the community, in a response that has taken the last 14 months and continues to go on. And I'll talk some more about what the work that still remains in that community. But after these 14 months, I was grateful for the fact that the college allowed me to go on sabbatical for a year. And so I'm currently on a sabbatical. And the first place I thought I would return to is to this community here at Holden, and to connect and understand better what the Yakima Valley, Central Washington, was about as another rural area that depends heavily on immigration. So that's where my interest came to return here. Working at Luther, we look at, you know, I can speak about what's happening in Iowa and someone in Minnesota, but particularly when we look at Iowa as a college for recruitment, we see in the majority of rural communities, which majority of Iowa is very rural in terms of land mass, most schools, if towns still have a school, many of them have had to consolidate, they have, let's say, 100 students graduating today. Many of them have 30 kids coming into kindergarten. So we're talking a huge drop in population in just 12 years. So 100 kids are graduating today, 30 are coming in the incoming class. Now that's not the case in every single town, and using that as a general, you know, reference to the fact that to one extent or another, this is the reality throughout most of Iowa rural communities. People are migrating, they're moving, as many of us earlier in Bible study talked about, the commonality now of the phrase, where are you from? This is something that at Holden is very common. You know, as soon as you meet somebody, it's the second question you'll always ask after saying, hi, my name is, to try to place people. The reason that question has become so significant is that many of us experience in our personal lives some kind of movement or migration. Well, what's happening in too many rural communities is that people are migrating from those rural communities to larger city centers or to other places, following what is traditional, the pull and push of immigration, either the pull towards something important, new, a new opportunity, or the push of having lost a job, of having some kind of an issue that means I need to leave the place where I live. Those two movements of pull and push have shaped immigration throughout history. So I was interested in returning to the Yakima Valley. This is a picture of Yakima in the early 1930s. And this kind of represents a little bit of what you'll see that happened as a change in Yakima. I want to use this as an example before we look at Postville as to what has happened in some rural communities. So what we have is rural communities that are decreasing in population, except for a few of them. In Iowa, the University of Iowa did a study in the mid-1990s that was focused on figuring out the future of rural Iowa. And in that study, they named four communities as the image of what the future rural Iowa would look like, where there was possibility for new rural communities. The four places that were named as the future of Iowa have all been the site of raids. One of the common elements all of these communities had was immigration. Postville, Iowa, Marshalltown, Storm Lake, Iowa, and I always forget the fourth one. But these communities had in common a reversal of this trend of a graduation class of 100 and an incoming class of 30. In the case of Postville, a graduating class this past year would have been about 120 kids. Their incoming class was about 150 kids. So they were a reversal of that trend. And throughout the communities where that is the case, in many of the rural towns in Iowa, it is because of immigration. So what happened in Yakima has been very similar. I don't know how many of you know the history of Yakima. I come to know in the last 2 weeks that I spent there with a lot of very gracious people who were willing to talk to me. This is a graph I put together just from the statistics from the Bureau, Census Bureau, on population. So you can see at the beginning of the 1900s, 1890, 1,500 people in the Yakima, in the city of Yakima. So this is in the center of the Yakima Valley. And you can see the spike to where they're estimated in 2007 was 83,000 people. This is astronomical growth for a rural community that is, slowly no longer become, at some point you decide, well, this isn't rural anymore, right? That growth is represented in many other cities around the country. But what's particular about this one is to see what motivates the moves. You can see certain jumps. And if you notice the jumps, notice what happened in the 1930s. Here's where you see all of the Arkies and the Okies moving to Washington in pursuit of land and a possibility. I talked to a variety of people when I was in Yakima that were gracious enough to sit and talk with me and share about their stories and their lives. I talked to one gentleman who is a grower who moved to Yakima in the 1930s from South Dakota. And he self-identified at the beginning of his conversation, "I moved here because of the Depression," with his family, who had lost their land and everything else, and so they moved out west. Then what was interesting to me is he said, "I moved out here in 1939. At that point, the city of Yakima ended on 35th Avenue. Didn't pay much attention to that. It was in the recording I was making. I had a conversation later on with a woman from Mexico who is came to work in the fields initially, now is a manager at a restaurant, a fast food restaurant. She moved here in the 90s, and she said, "When I moved to Yakima, the city got to about 65th Avenue. Now, I didn't ask her the question. She just introduced herself that way. I started to notice people would do this. They would talk about where the city was at when they moved there, as if this represented when the city was most ideal. when I came, and then everybody else showed up. And they would all say the city would go this far, and then after that, it was all orchard. There was a sense of just nostalgia for that time, simplicity, and life was somehow better. And then the last person I talked to in the last few days I was there was actually a pastor who moved to the community 8 months ago to serve a church that is right on what is now the edge of town, a town that used to be way out there, and now Yakima has come to meet it. And he also told me, "I live on 106th Street, where the edge of Yakima is now, 106th Avenue. So you see this movement from 31st to 35th to 65th to 106th. That is represented in this population growth. What caused these changes? Well, one of the biggest things that happened was the introduction of the canals that brought water from the mountains into the valley. When you drive into that area, many of you, I'm sure, are more familiar with this territory than I am, when you come into it, it's all desert except where you can pour water. And as one person told me, if you see sage growing, it's good land, and all it needs is water. So that's the indicator. I said, no. So I guess South Dakota's got lots of promise. The canals were a huge project, started in 1907, and then got a boost during the shovel-ready projects of the 1930s, where they came in and built this huge infrastructure that caused the valley to turn into an incredible Eden. I've spent lots of time in Iowa. I've lived in Iowa now for 8 years, so not terribly long, but significant enough. And other parts of the Midwest, I've gotten very used to monocropping, where you have large expanses of one crop, corn, soybeans, whatever it is, just huge expanses. Walking around this valley, driving around it with growers, with field workers, it's incredible. I met one grower that raises about 30 different crops. He's got a lot of acreage. But it's amazing to see this beautiful plot of land that everything can grow in there. We made a list that now in the valley, they are harvesting or working, towards harvest for 9 months out of the year. It's no longer this short season. It's now 9 months, beginning with asparagus at the beginning and apples that run all year round with production because of lots of changes. And as I talk to them, you can see this huge transition to what the Yakima Valley and the city of Yakima now looks like. So what's the point of this? Migration is something that shapes human life and has throughout generations. In the Bible study in the morning, the last two mornings, we have talked about the fact that if we look at biblical characters, and we could do this again and make a list of them, if we just name out loud all of the biblical characters, we can immediately realize that all of them are immigrants. So let's name a few. Who are biblical characters?
Naomi.
Naomi.
Ruth.
Mary, Moses, Abraham, Joseph and his brothers end up migrating. Jacob. Of course, there's Jesus, who migrates as an infant, you know, and then spends the rest of his ministry saying the most common phrase, let's go to the other side. Constantly Christendom, al otro lado, which is what people do when they migrate north. So migration is something that has shaped human history, and it is very dependent on a wide variety of factors. It's dependent on economics, it's dependent on production methods. In the case of the Yakima Valley, it had to do with water being brought in. The need for labor keeps booming, not only because larger plots of land are being, you know, harvested and more crops are going in, but also because technology has allowed, you know, things like, one of the growers was just astonished. He said, can you believe that cherries are flown to Japan? I mean, this is a guy who came in 1939, he's been retired for 20 years. This blows his mind. He's like, how much do they pay for these cherries? And they get to fly them to Japan. So what has changed in the last 30 years in terms of economics? We live in a time where mobility is extremely common. In fact, today, the largest group of people in the history of the world are on the move. The largest group of people in the history of the world are on the move today, more than there has ever been. In 1952, the High Commission for Refugees was set up by the United Nations, and it came to define, in the period following World War II, the idea of a refugee. It came about in the need of resettling people following this worldwide conflict. At the time it was formed, the refugees are concerned, which was the definition that they used, was about 1 million people that still needed to be resettled following the war. Today, the High Commissioner for Refugees identifies 10.5 million refugees as refugees of concern to its institution. 10 times the number of people who were displaced by the 1950s following World War II. And that's only the people who are refugees. But movement is not only caused by conflict and distress. There's not only the push of immigration, but also the pull. As people were coming in, I asked a little bit about where people are from, so we dotted a little bit of this beautiful map of the United States here. Let's do something really quick. If you can take a look at the label of somebody, of the stuff that you're carrying with you. Phones, watches, watches never have where they're made. But look at where things were made that you're carrying with you. Either your clothing, maybe somebody around you can help you look at the labels on your clothing. Okay, so we'll call out some of these. China,
Guatemala,
Los Angeles, Bangladesh, I'm sorry, what was that?
Macau.
Island of Macau, I think I know. Pacific.
Yeah.
Honduras.
Vietnam.
I should be doing this in a different color here, sorry. Okay, Vietnam. China again. Any others? Germany?
Thailand?
New Hampshire?
Croatia?
Holden? Yeah, some people say that Holden. There you go.
Lesotho?
Turkey?
Mexico?
Turkey, Mexico?
Latvia?
Okay. We could probably keep doing this. You got the chest, right? And Denmark. Okay, so we got another European here. Look at this. This is what's happening. All of these products have made their way to Holden Village this weekend. I got this bill in my wallet. It's a $1 bill, and it has this little stamp, you know, trace this dollar. And you can go on the website and key in the serial number on it, and you can check out where this dollar has been. It's quite interesting to do that at Holden. Then this dollar has been to Holden. We'll see where it goes from here. This is an incredible world we live in. I like to talk about the well-traveled yogurt. You know, if you think about a little container of Yoplait, this is the well-traveled yogurt. This little container of Yoplait has traveled more than most of us have in our lives. By the time we can buy it for 75 cents at the local grocery store. This little container of Yoplait has milk that may be from a wide variety of places and countries. It contains cultures that were raised, God knows where, for, you know, making it into yogurt. It's got coloring in it that was probably produced somewhere else. The fruit that is either in it or that it was prepared in the vicinity of fruit came from somewhere else. The plastic that it's made out of, the, you know, the little lid on it and the metal that goes into that, the ink on the lettering of it has traveled significant differences. All of this for something I can buy for 75 cents on my local grocery store. It's an incredible accomplishment in many ways for humanity. Why is that? How can that possibly be? What has impacted this kind of this radical change in the way we, because if you think about what, was this this way 100 years ago?
Transportation.
Efficiencies
of scale.
Scale, the way we can kind of mass produce things.
NAFTA.
We'll come back to NAFTA after a little bit, so we'll leave it up here. So free trade agreements that we have signed. What else?
Cheap labor.
Now, we talked about cheap labor twice. One, cheap labor in the rural areas. Markets are always looking for that cheap labor. What's happening in the United States is that we have outsourced everything we can. The number of things we produce locally has reduced because of mass of scale. We figured somebody else can do it cheaper, we'll specialize. But one of the things that has happened is that we've outsourced everything we can, but that which we cannot outsource, we have started to insource labor. Where do immigrants work? Particular undocumented immigrants. Slaughtering cows. They work in chickens. Landscaping, construction. Agriculture, things we cannot outsource, but that we are beginning to outsource. The state of Michigan has lost an estimated 30 to 40% of its fruit crops because of the lack of labor and the cost of labor. And so that they have begun to ship all of the production. Farms are moving abroad to be able to produce things cheaper. Either you're going to bring the labor in or you're going to bring the product out. This is one of the challenges that has come about with this amazing development. I'm not providing the answers tonight. I'm asking that we realize the complexities of what is happening in our world. For those of you who may have memories about this, what is different in a supermarket from the 1970s to a supermarket today?
Choice.
You know, no longer is there just toothpaste, there is an aisle dedicated to toothpaste. Okay, what else has changed?
Size.
The average grocery store, I'm talking about a neighborhood grocery store, not a convenience store, had somewhere around 7,000 products in the 1970s. Today, they have an estimated 70,000 to 100,000 different products in their inventory. And this is not touching Walmart. These are huge, massive scale of products coming to us from everywhere in the world.
Year-round strawberries and grapes?
Yeah.
Cantaloupe and...
Because we bring them from everywhere. No longer can we say apples are from Washington or Michigan. They may be from Chile, or they could be from somewhere in China. New Zealand, yeah.
Computers have made a difference.
Our ability to communicate and our ability to move. Lots of movement has increased. So we have movement of people because of need and desperation, the movement of conflict, but we also have the movement of products. Hugely increasing. And along with that, the freedom of movement of people. If you have a U.S. passport, if you're a U.S. citizen and have a U.S. passport, today you can travel to 195 countries around the world without asking for permission. All you have to do is buy a ticket, get on the plane. You might have to fill out some paperwork on the plane or when you land, but you don't have to ask for permission. If you, like I do, have a Guatemalan passport, my wife says it's like traveling. Traveling with a Guatemalan passport is like traveling with a Discover card. It's not accepted everywhere. In fact, with a Guatemalan passport alone, you can't go anywhere. You cannot leave the country. Not because Guatemala won't let you leave. They're fine if you go. The problem is nobody else will let you in without first fulfilling paperwork to even travel there to visit. And the likelihood of you getting that permission depends highly on your economic level, your education, and your connections. So when there is a huge increased labor need in some of our rural areas, those who come to do that work cannot travel there under the existing conditions. What we have is this huge increase in mobility. I see it on campus with students. Every J term at Luther College, where we have 2,500 students about, 500 of them are abroad during J term. This is nuts. And it's incredible to think about. When you think about those of you who have grandchildren, think about how much more, how many more opportunities your grandchildren have had. So what we have is this huge increase in the ability of some people to move freely because of all of these things we talked about. Technology, money, resources, all of these things. And at the same time, while we're signing all these free trade agreements, we have also had an increased restriction on the mobility of some people. Postville happens right here, where these two movements collapse. And they are simply unsustainable. People will move either in search of opportunity or to run away from their struggle. And our policies currently do not reflect our economic realities. They do not currently, are not tied. When we sign an agreement like NAFTA, it never includes a discussion about immigration and what consequences it will have. One of the things people have always done is follow the trade. They always have done that through our history. Think about the story of Joseph in the Bible. Remember Joseph, you know, he had the nice long-sleeved technicolor coat. Why is it significant that it's long-sleeved?
Is it all-season
coat? What? All-season coat? No, that's all. What else?
Carry food.
Huh?
Carry food.
I don't know. Have you ever tried doing a workout in a field with a long coat? And a nice, expensive, colorful coat?
Status?
Yeah, status. It's not meant to be for work. Joseph wasn't supposed to do much work. That was the problem, you know, that led to some disagreement between him and his brothers. The preference given to him, the coat meant a lot. So when his father, in all his infinite wisdom, sends the youngest son to go check out on the work of the older brothers who are hard at work while the younger brother's hanging out at home with his nice coat, things are likely to blow up. But what happens when Joseph goes off to look for his brothers? Anybody remember? Before he gets there, what happens? No, even before. He gets lost. He can't find them. Why? Because he doesn't know where they work. He's never been there. He has no idea where these people work. But have you noticed in the story that everybody else seems to know where they are? Except Joseph. And where are they? In Shechem. Why? That's the trading post. And everybody knows that you go trade in Shechem. That's where the trading routes go by. And everybody knows this except Joseph because he hasn't lifted a finger in his life. So he follows to Shechem, gets into major trouble with his brothers. And then what happens to him? They dig him out of the pit and what?
Sell him
to the traders that conveniently are just walking on by. And what's interesting in the story is that we don't know if it was Ishmaelites or Midianites. Because the story goes back and forth between both of them. Why? Because a bunch of trading caravans go by there. It's a common route, and they can't remember which one it was. But they did know one thing for sure. Where was it going?
Egypt.
They knew that. They knew that, and when famine strikes their land years later, where do they go?
Egypt.
Why? Because they've been shipping the food there for generations. And they know when there is need, they will follow the trade in the way that people have throughout centuries and will throughout centuries. Irma, a woman who was detained in the raid in Postville, is a woman from a small town in Guatemala like many of the people detained in Postville. 389 people were detained in the Postville raid. 300 of them were originally from small villages in Guatemala, most of them uneducated. Irma was a single mother of two, who knew nothing but work from the time she was 7 years old. Like many of the other people in Postville, her life was framed by debt, by conflict, that was the result of 36 years of conflict in Guatemala. And so she was working, growing roses. This was difficult work. She made her way through the company until she ended up shipping those roses. She came to the packing office, or the packing department. And she would label those boxes and packages of roses to ship, and she would label them all to go to the United States and to Europe. After 5 years, Irma lost her job. Nothing she did, the company folded, moved on. So she was out of work. Started looking for work and find work, like many other people, picking coffee. Again, she made her way through the company, ended up shipping the coffee because she had experience in that, and she ended up shipping the coffee again, putting labels to go to the United States and to Europe. After 5 years, that company closed up. And she still didn't know why. She just knew she was again out of a job. What she didn't know is that agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA, which is the Central American equivalent of that, give companies a 5-year tax-free ride into the country as an incentive to move to the country. But in 5 years, there are more that have made their investment, and they pack up and go. And people that have moved there to supply their labor end up displaced and needing to find work like Irma did. And when she could find no other work, Irma did what Joseph had done before and his brothers had done before. She followed the trade to the places where she knew the products were because she had been sending them there for years. And knowing the need of her family, this woman who had never broken a law, whose piety and personal faith and personal convictions are such that she cannot do anything without asking for permission, did the unthinkable by violating what she knew to be a law that restricted her, but felt she had absolutely no choice. Tulsa, Iowa is a community in the middle of Northeast Iowa, where the little A is up there. And it's a very small town, 2,300 people. It's the population of Tulsa around that on May 12th when the raid happened. This is an aerial picture from Google Maps. And you can see the entirety of the town. There's not a lot of blocks. You can walk in and out of town. The company is this big section right here, agri-processors. We'll watch a brief video of a documentary. It's a trailer of a documentary being put together right now. It's in post-production by Luis Argueta, who I've come to know really well through the experience of the last 14 months and admire his work. I'll say a couple of brief things in the introduction to that video. We'll watch the video and then just open up for conversation following that. The video is both in English and Spanish, but subtitled to whatever language is not being spoken. But one of the things you'll notice in the video is that 900 operatives came to do the raid in Tulsa. 900 ICE operatives. They came dressed in black with assault weapons, two black helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters flying on top of the town to raid this plant on the edge of town. If anybody was going to run away, it looked like they were coming to get Osama bin Laden. If they came into that place and if anybody were to run away, where would they go? What was the fear? What was the point and the function of this raid? Do you want to switch?
I'm Jeff Abbas. Thanks for joining me this morning for Roots in Americana Music on member-supported KPDL 89.1 Postville Community Radio for the Four County area.
As I went walking, I heard the note highway. I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
During our May 12th operation at Agri-Processors in Postville, Iowa, ICE agents executed criminal and civil search warrants at the company, resulting in the arrest of 389 undocumented alien workers.
Ya estaba lleno de migración adentro.
Digo que a mi amiga, vamos. Yo le contesté que no. No he hecho nada, ni he hecho daño a nadie, no más trabajaba.
Muchas mujeres estaban aterrorizadas y decían Y ahora mis hijos. Y ahora mis hijos. Ellas nomás estaban que sus hijos porque muchas madres tenían a los niños con las niñas.
ICE is first and foremost a federal law enforcement agency. Our agents and officers perform the mission lawfully, professionally, and compassionately.
Llegaron con otro muchacho que era compañero de trabajo mío y lo sentaron de un jalón de pelo, lo sentaron una vez al muchacho. Y vi cuando le pegaron, les pegaban a los que se huían y las mujeres nos gritaban. Y cuando una muchacha se quiso ver huido y se le sacó de las manos, una mujer de piel morena que dijo que era gente de migración le dijo, párate puta, párate perra, porque no puedes huirte y no tienes por qué huirte.
Vi a la policía que estaba abajo, empezaron a maltratar y se reían de nosotros. Y decían, hijos de puta, cabrones, desgraciados, hoy ya les llegó la gran puta. Y no traten de huir porque el que huye lo puede agarrar a patadas y si muere, quien muere y se va al hospital, que se vaya al hospital.
Nos quitaron las botas de hule cagado y nos pusieron una cadena aquí. Y nos pusieron pasaron la cadena por las chachas y nos pegaron las manos aquí. Después nos hincaron y nos amarraron unas cadenas.
We got into the ambulance and we drove up to Agra. All of a sudden, I see lines and rows of Hispanic workers on their knees like dogs, and they were just chained.
And the environment was joking. It was kind of laughing. One of the ICE agents was making a joke out of how this individual had gotten hurt. They cuffed him, they put him on the cot, they put him in. Two ICE agents jumped in the back of me. When I put the oxygen on, when I did the things that I was supposed to do, there were statements made like, why bother with that? And one of the ICE agents kept saying, hey, if he needs an IV, I can stick him with a needle. And he kept saying it over and over like I was going to let him do it.
Extraordinary care was taken to determine if any of the arrestees were sole caregivers or raised other humanitarian concerns.
Vi a mis amigos todos, desde el más grande hasta el más chico, porque sus padres estaban trabajando ahí.
¿Y tú qué decías?
Nomás pensar en mi mamá, sabía que ella se la llevaba. Mi mamá se quedó como en shock y dijo, yo no tengo nada, no tengo hijos ni nada, estoy sola aquí.
Detainees were questioned no less than 3 times about humanitarian issues such as child custody or serious medical concerns.
Cuando la agarraron, una guatemalteca dijo que ella tenía hijos y el de inmigración dijo, te lo vamos a traer para que se vaya contigo. Y ella tuvo miedo que nos iba a agarrar y por eso dijo que no tenía nadie. And they know now that we are minors, pero no la sacan.
ICE arranged to have DIHS professionals at the arrest site to merely determine the needs of any and status of any children affected by the operation.
Como era menor de edad, me fueron a meter donde estaban todas las que tenían hijos. Y luego, no sé qué, me fueron a traer, me encadenaron, me subieron a un bus y luego me llevaron hasta la estación donde estaban y morí.
Muy triste porque le quitaron a uno su trabajo y su sustento de cada semana. Yo venía aquí a la iglesia caminando y me encontró un americano. Y me dice, ¿traes dinero para comer hoy? Y le dije, no. No, le dije, no. Ahorita no tengo cabeza para pensar en comer. Se ve la niña así y saca su bolsa y me da $60. Yo lo que hice fue me agarré y le dije, ay, me siento tan infeliz así que como que si uno les diera lástima. Y me dijo, no, yo te ayudo porque yo puedo. Nomás lo pongo así y ya al rato da una luz verde. Es que ya está cargada.
¿Y ahorita qué? Teniendo dinero no he trabajado desde que me agarraron el 12 de mayo, no he trabajado, pero ni siquiera un día. La iglesia nos está ayudando. Con toda la gente que está donando dinero nos están ayudando. Y por la cobija no dan comida, no dan de todo.
These people that were here, they're wonderful workers. All they wanted, the same thing like you and I wanted, was a better life. And the little kids here are U.S. citizens. What's going to happen? Just all of this torment, devastation and fear, that's what you could call Postville. Devastation and fear.
Postville was an experiment designed to instill fear among the country's immigrant population. It was supposed to be a pilot operation to serve as a model for future raids.
All little call you will be born.
feds did not take into account was how the town's people, the workers, and the world would react.
ICE should direct its enforcement resources toward investigations of high-level threats to national security and employers that deliberately violate the law, not workers who are merely trying to feed their families and who contribute to the U.S. economy and to our social fabric.
Our government has left the humanitarian crisis for Sister Mary McAuley and her good neighbors to cure. I call on all to contribute to St. Bridget's Church and on the federal government to respond with aid that guarantees survival for their schools, businesses, and institutions. It is time for America to adopt postal.
I want to assure you, we will continue to stand with you, work with you, and pray with you. We will continue to challenge your employers who exploit you. We will continue to challenge our legislators. We will continue to challenge one another until that day comes when we will be able to rise to new life. It is at that point that together we will stand and proclaim, blessed are you, blessed is our God.
This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Any reactions or comments?
I'm Heidi. I actually student taught in this community last fall before coming here in January. And a really interesting variable in this whole thing is just the reaction of all the farm kids and kind of all the other people in Postville. And I didn't feel like this documentary really depicted that at all. But then at the same time, the sad thing is that there isn't, from what I saw being a teacher in the school, there isn't much to depict. Because it was such an us-them thing. This happened to this, to the, that population of our town. Kind of all the teachers are the us population who is untouched by this raid was just silenced. And there wasn't a lot of support in the school from what I saw, not a whole lot of conversation. It's as if the town of Postville, or a large majority of Postville itself, didn't know how to talk about this. Or there wasn't space given to talk about it. It's like, hey kids, this incredible thing happened 3 months ago, but we're going to leave it in history and try to learn that. And it just is, was a really jarring experience.
I just finished the book, and you know, it leaves off in like 2006.
A little earlier.
Stephen Bloom, something earlier. And the conditions, at least at that time, for all the workers that weren't of the Jewish, the Hasidic Jewish group, were miserable. I mean, was that still the state when the raid happened, the $6 an hour, or whatever, the extreme minimum wage and the long hours, and that hadn't changed? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was almost like liberation for them. I mean, I know they needed to work, but it's like the worst job possible in the United States.
And what's difficult about it is that, you know, 42 people were brought back after spending 5 months in prison following the raid. They were given work permits 2 months later after that. For 2 months, that were dependent on the community, in addition to others who were left behind. All of them are back at agriprocessors now that they have work. So I think that it's really a complicated question. And I think that What happened in Postville, the prosecution currently going against the company, it's taken 14 months for the case. The case hasn't even, none of the cases for against the company and its owners has gone to court yet. There's all these, you know, it takes time to do justice. It took 3 days to send 300 people to prison on charges of felon. But it's taken 14 months to build a case against the company. What has been built against the company, all of these labor abuses, were not under investigation by immigration. In fact, it destroyed the investigation, the ongoing investigation by the Labor Department. Part of the issue in immigration and the reason that prices or labor or costs is driven down is not by the presence of undocumented workers, but it is by the lack of enforcement or labor laws. A person standing in the country from immigration has nothing to do in the United States with whether they qualify for workers' rights or not. They still pay their taxes. Most people think immigrants don't, but most immigrants do, unless the employers know they are undocumented and don't take their taxes away. Most U.S. citizens wouldn't pay their taxes if they were taken away from their paycheck. So most, and in the case of everybody in Postville, they were all paying taxes. It was taken out of their paychecks.
How did they know they were? Excuse me.
No, go ahead. And then
how did they know they were undocumented?
Part of the reason, there's lots of stated official reasons why Postville was picked. One of them had to do later on with the concerns about labor violations. Even though all of the charges related to labor violations, most of the cases that they are building depend on witnesses that we as a community have identified and heard their story. Because most of the people who have been victims were rounded up on the border without ever asking them a question about whether they were victims or not. So, you know, the concern is that the enforcement and immigration will say that's not our job, that's the Labor Department. Our job is to enforce immigration law. So how do they know that they were undocumented? One of the issues within immigration enforcement in the last 8 years, as it began to escalate, enforcement began to escalate, one of the things that they were doing is that they were using the Social Security database as a way to identify companies that had undocumented workers or the possibility of the undocumented workers. This is what they are proposing to use as part of E-Verify that has actually been passed in some of the bills going through Congress right now as a way to make sure employers aren't hiring undocumented workers. Problem is, of course, that the E-Verify list that runs against Social Security is filled with mistakes. But by and large, what they were doing is they would send the company a notice saying, this is the no-match list. And they would come up with this huge list. They'll send them and say, you have 400 numbers that don't match of the people that you're submitting taxes or and Social Security on. So the Social Security Administration is receiving all this money that nobody's ever going to claim. And so they just notify them, tell them there's 400 people here that aren't matching. So the company would send out a note to all their employees and say, you need a new number. They wouldn't say it that way. On the check, on the stub, it would say, oh, there's an issue with your Social Security. You know, please come into the office to figure it out. Well, they're coming to the office and they just end up with a new number. Either, this is part of what's being still investigated, whether the company actually physically handed them the new paperwork or they went down the street somewhere and bought it for $300. But as these lists kept getting issued repeatedly and the numbers kept not matching, then the problem was that in their effort, many people's numbers started to match existing numbers. They would match existing numbers but not match the name. That became a huge issue after the raid, because then they did this prosecution against them. Not only did they detain all the people, but then they accused them of aggravated ID theft. And that's why they prosecuted 300 of them, other than the people who were left behind because of humanitarian reasons. So imagine going to court. What they did, this is something that should concern all of us, regardless of our views on immigration. They relocated for the first time in the history of Iowa, the entire federal court, down to the cattle congress. This is the place where cows are exhibited and sold. And they set up the court there. And they process people in groups of 10. Each defendant, each lawyer that was appointed by the court, public defendants, was representing an estimated 17 people in a different language, and they had 7 days for them to accept the plea. And this is supposedly to represent them on the complicated charges of aggravated ID theft. The function of that accusation was a hammer to force people to plead. Because they were told, these are people whose families depend on the work they are doing daily, who have huge amounts of debt back home, who have left because of really difficult circumstances. And they were told, through translators in a context where they were terrified after being rounded up like animals. And they were told, you can hang out for a trial, it will take 6 to 8 months, and then you're facing 2 to 10 years in prison. Or you can sign here and in 5 months we'll send you home. 307 people will offer a plea, 306 took it. So, here and then, oh, I'm sorry, back there first and then here and then.
I felt like the film did a really good job of capturing the human tragedy on the with people directly impacted by the rape. You know, living in Cedar Rapids at the time of that, we've just been very aware ever since then. I mean, it's just totally decimated the town too, so it's just emptied out the town, and you know, they have all these vacant properties and their businesses are failing because they don't have anybody to actually live in their restaurants and so on. I mean, that's the story we hear. But then I think the other part of it was that the raid was May 12th, is that right? And then May 25th, very, you know, fairly close by in Parkersburg, half the town was wiped out by a tornado, and then all the floods started happening. So the raid captured everybody's attention and everybody wanted to help. And then I think so much of the energy of Iowa got siphoned off from that. So, I mean, what was already a tragedy, I feel like multiplied so many times over because they lost people's attention, they lost the money that they would have been sending to help because people started to focus in on their own communities.
The response in Postville was done by a small group of people a large group of people over a long period of time. One of the challenges is that it felt very much, and it continues to feel like, responding to a natural disaster without access to any federal, state aid, without the Red Cross moving in to do anything. And so the community is left to handle it. This is a place where, as a community of faith, we need to engage the conversation about immigration. Because the assumption is NGOs will move in. In rural communities, there are no NGOs.
And the church has really stepped up, and in Cedar Rapids, the churches were really starting to step up and figure out what they could do to help and so on. And then suddenly, the attention shifted so much in mid-June when the floods happened that, you know, I know Immaculate Conception, which is the Spanish-speaking church in Cedar Rapids, was still doing a lot. But suddenly, we were getting just tons of Hispanic workers coming and being terribly exploited in our own community doing flood cleanup. So
many of whom are coming from Postville. They actually showed up. People showed up to recruit people in Postville because they knew, even though they were hiding in the church and scared, many of them were asking us if they could go to work. They had monitoring devices that would control their every move, so they couldn't go to work, but they were desperate to do it. We had a couple questions here and then in the front here.
Just in terms of human trafficking, was there a group in Guatemala that got these folks here? Was there some network?
There's some concerns about human trafficking. Actually, 22 people out of the group that remain behind have received what are called U visas. Not any of them yet T visas, which are for human trafficking. So there's concern about elements of this being, you know, related to some form of human traffic. The difficulty with human traffic is that it's another area we currently enforce. There's a lot of conversation about the importance of enforcing immigration laws, but it's very selective enforcement. T visas, which are basically, you know, to help people who are victims of human trafficking, if they help prosecute the people who have trafficked them, then they'll be given a visa. In the last 8 years, 5,000 are awarded every year, could be awarded every year, so it's 40,000 possible visas in the last 8 years. An internal study from immigration indicated that only 1,400 have been given, less than 4%. So this is not a part of the law that we are enforcing, even though estimates of human trafficking are really, really high. So here in New Carmenta.
Serves them right because they're illegals and they're going to cheat Social Security and they're going to get free health care and they're going to get... I had an email just about a week before we came, and it was, you know, sign this petition because they're all going to... all the illegals are going to get Social Security Well, I went to Urban Legends to check it out, Snopes.com, and this thing goes back for 10 years. It's been cycling around. I had fun going to a relative who sent it to me, and I said, I think you've been bamboozled. You know, if you check out Snopes, you'll see this is a non-issue. That is not, there's nothing in Congress that is talking about this. But there's a lot of bad information on the internet, and if you are a little bit naive and you get these emails, doesn't matter whether you sign them or not, as you say, gee, is that really so? You know, golly, I didn't know that.
I think that, you know, in some people's perceptions, you know, the best life you could possibly have is being an illegal immigrant in the United States. I mean, you have just a great life. The difficulty is that we can get really hung up in the debate of, you know, myth-busting. I think it's important to inform and to educate. But I think that what we have to figure out, and this is, again, the part where faith communities need to have a role, is to find a way to move towards workable solutions. We're going to sit on very different places. The first thing we need to say is there aren't two sides to immigration. There's a whole gamut of where people stand in convictions and views, and we can engage in conversation about it that's fruitful and important. But we have to begin to work towards solutions that are workable. For the sake of 12 million people whose lives are on the verge all the time, and for our own sake, you know, our rural communities continue to be desperate for labor. One of the specific issues, I'll go to Carmen in just a second, one of the, you know, there was a comment online to an article that was published by the Yakima Herald when I was there. One of the commentaries was, well, you know, it's a good thing they closed that plant. You know, the next week, there were people around the block, good, hardworking Americans, to sign up for work at that plant. The plant went broke in November, 6 months after the raid, after trying everything to get workers. They offered much higher wages, they promised to change their ways, they did everything they could. And they went through wave after wave of workers from everywhere around the country, regionally, you know, people coming out of early release from prison, everything they could imagine, and they could not keep a labor force. The only stable force they finally got to, that got into 30% of their capacity, was immigrants from Somalia, who were refugees that had been resettled into regional areas, into Waterloo and Minneapolis, and people from Palau, 8,000 miles away, that were flown in to work in Northeast Iowa.
Conditions are that deplorable that people just wouldn't keep the jobs?
I think that this is an issue because it's not just the plant. I mean, it's too easy a solution. The day after the raid in Poso, 70% of the workforce at the Swift plant in Waterloo that was raided already a few years ago disappeared the next day. They were all sick. I mean, this is an industry-wide issue. And it's the same thing in construction. It's the same thing in Yakima Valley. There's this vine, you know, this winery, and the grower at the winery, when I was asking him about labor, you know, we're doing wine tasting, and I'm asking him about the labor force, and he said, oh, of course, they're all Mexicans. And they're happy as clams, you know, they come up and they work and they just go back. They're happy as clams, you know, they're just gonna move back and forth, no big deal. But the assumption is, yeah, that's who does the work out of the field. 100% of every single field worker place I went, 100% of the meatpacking plant, Washington Beef, is all Hispanic labor, all of it. So I don't know, we might be able to do some of it, but then we all have to be willing to pay a lot more for our food and figure out a way to market it and all these things. And those are important things. We need to begin enforcing our laws. But it's not only about agri-processors. This is an issue of the inability for all of these companies around the country to attract labor force. And the reality is, particularly for meatpacking, is that immigrants have always done meatpacking in the United States. 90% of meatpacking was handled by Chicago in the 1890s. That's where Al Capone got all his money and power. It was all the immigrants that did all that work, and they always have in the United States. It's the first rung as to how people come into the labor market. Should it be that way? What can we do about it? That's where the conversation, but this is where we need the workable solution. So Carmen, and then I think you want to.
Well, I had a question you already answered about the economic impact in the community. I also wanted to ask you, how many other cities have had the same thing? Because I know in New Jersey, a couple cities have been raided. And then what kind of a reaction did your civic leaders have, like your mayor, your elected officials? How did they help the people of the
town? I'll go back a little bit to economic impact. Some of it, you know, you mentioned already, a couple of people have too. 40% of the population of the town is gone. The company finally was bought out of bankruptcy court last week and is very uncertain about its future. And right now, they have no idea how they're going to supply their labor. There are two landlords left in town, really. I mean, most of them have filed for bankruptcy and their properties are being managed by others until they figure out a way forward. It's like dropping a pebble in the water and the ripples go wide. 36 million chickens made their way through this packing plant every year. When the raid happened, there's 36 million chickens in waiting, coming through all over Iowa and southern Minnesota. Counties were left with tons of overgrown chickens they didn't know what to do with because they didn't belong to anybody because the company was broke and couldn't manage them. I met a guy way up in Austin, Minnesota, you know, it's about 3 hours from Poulsville, who told me, I don't know where to take my cows to. That's where I took them, that's who bought them. There's an electrician in town who is self-employed. He had $300,000 worth of work he had done for the company that he was left owed that. And so he's broke. There's a guy, Don, who, you know, was one of these displaced farmers from the 80s, who was a trucker for the company for 20 years. And after the raid, he is now working as a hired hand in the farm his grandfather settled 150 years earlier because he can't find any other work. And now he's at the hired hand there trying to make a living. So the impact was broad throughout. Similar things have happened in other communities, but the impact in the broader community is easier to hide. What's significant about Postal is that you cannot hide that impact. You've got 2,300 people, 400 of them removed, impacts half the population of the town. While parts of the institutions and the community is trying to move on, they don't want to be a byword to what's wrong with our immigration system. And so there's ways that are unhelpful or healthy of denial, of not wanting to talk about it, or feeling that the best thing to do is to move on. But there have been an incredible resilience in the community to try to figure out a way forward. Initially, the city officials were very mute. I think they kind of assumed this would blow over, somehow it would just sort of solve itself. You know, they had some issues from previous years in which they had sort of spoken on behalf of the company when accusations about labor abuses, animal rights abuses, you know, the city, you know, officials had spoken on behalf of the company, so they were in a funny place. And it took a while before they began to, I mean, eventually the mayor resigned, the one that had been there for the raid, and a new mayor came in because of the level of anxiety and conflict within the community. Let's take just two more questions and then we'll kind of wrap it up and you know, again, people can stay if they'd like to for more conversation, but I want to be mindful of time here.
Well, what was moving, I think, was the response of the community, but I did not see the response of the plane. And I live in Fremont, Nebraska, where we have quite a big issue also because outsiders from, I believe, Missouri are trying to motivate a movement to require the registration of everybody. Because the company is outside of city limits, they're going after housing. Mm-hmm. So anybody who rents to an illegal immigrant, they're going to go after, try to get that on the legislation. Mm-hmm. But where are the companies who hire them? Why aren't they lobbying the government? I don't understand that. If they're hiring, why aren't they backing up what they're doing?
Mm-hmm. I think others might be better able than me to answer that question. I can tell you about, you know, in Postville, particularly, the plant is in disarray. You know, they're trying to figure out a way to survive. And ultimately, the initial reaction was for many of the owners and the people in the company, they didn't really care. You know, we had people driving by the church where 400 people were huddled in, scared. You know, and the supervisors in the company would drive by and yell at them and be, you know, don't be lazy, come back to work. I mean, so it's a mix, you know, as to whether companies really, there is a lot of lobbies for the part of agriculture and others. There's the ag business legislation that's going through, ag jobs, is currently being pushed. It has a lot of support from industries that depend heavily on immigration because we don't have enough. Again, our economics, our policies do not reflect our economic needs. And so there are some employers that are trying to figure out a way to say we've got to have better immigration policies that reflect our reality. And that's an issue not only in low-skill labor, but also in high-skill labor. Google has had to set up offices in Canada and other places because they can't get the visas to bring their workers or their workers' families to the United States. And so they've had to move, you know, to other locations as well. So I think there was somebody back here, and then again, I'll wrap up sort of officially. If people need to go, we can do that, and then we can continue conversation with those that need to stay.
My name is Katie, and I graduated from Luther a week after the raid in Postville. And I remember thinking, oh, this is Decorah, Iowa. It's strange that there's two helicopters surrounding our area on the 12th. And very shortly after that, you know, working at a daycare center, there were parents that weren't there to pick up their kids, their Hispanic kids, that it was a pretty incredible experience. And I think what David won't tell you is he was really instrumental on the Luther campus in networking students to respond to that, to provide a venue to be able to feel this anger and frustration and unknowing. And I'm really pleased with the documentary, the beginning of it, that it's very personal. And those are people that I know. And that this is a beginning of a conversation, you know, that needs to continue. And I would encourage you to run with it.
One of the things, just because a couple of comments I've made about this particular trailer, this trailer was put together just for conversations like this. It's actually, Luis has probably 3,000 hours of interviews by now, of everything. People in town, there's community, city leaders, elected officials. He's traveled 5 times to Guatemala and to Mexico to talk with people who were deported. He's doing this all on his own. So if you go to their website, it's thepostalrate.com, abusethepostalrate.com, you can make a donation there as well to make sure that the story does get told. PBS just issued a documentary 2 nights ago on their online. If you go to PBS online, you'll see a postal documentary as well done by another independent filmmaker that focuses primarily on the economic impact of the raid. So there's some pieces that are out there. What's significant here is this story could happen in all of our communities. What Postville shows is that we cannot deport our way out of this problem. What it shows is that the economic impact of immigrants in our communities is huge. And no matter what else we try to convince ourselves of, that they contribute hugely to the communities. That does not mean that they don't come with certain struggles and challenges like any other population would. But it does mean that, in the words of one of the people I interviewed in Yakima, that the church, labor movement, and politicians have to pay attention to immigrants because that's where our future lies, whether we want to or not. His comment made me think, as I heard him speak, of Mordecai in the story of Esther, who goes to Esther and says to her, "Do not think that because you're on the inside, you're going to be spared. God will work. God will act. But it's perhaps for just this moment that you have been placed where you are." And I think that that's the part that the church needs to hear. Martin Luther King grieved about the fact that the church is often the taillights of society and not its headlights. This is one of the issues on which we cannot afford to lag behind. Are we the future of our own, the way that our children and those who are coming into the nation will see and judge the church, I think will in large part be based on how we engage or not engage this particular issue. So thank you much for your time tonight.